Good afternoon. I would like to start with the disclosure violations that we have alleged. There are basically four different disclosure violations, and if I categorize them. The first one can be summarized as the defendants knew that there were extreme operational problems at Blockbuster, making it unlikely that Blockbuster could fund its business plan. The Court of Chancery dismissed this claim for basically two reasons. I believe one reason is that the Court of Chancery found that adequate risk factors had been disclosed in the prospectus. On the second basis, the Court of Chancery, I believe, did not accurately characterize the claim. With all due respect to the Vice Chancellor, I believe he characterized the claim as being limited to a particular piece of evidence in support of the claim, which was a document which we learned about from and through attorneys who had contacted an ex-employee at Blockbuster, who claimed that she had prepared an analysis of Blockbuster's cash flows, which demonstrated which Blockbuster was unable to meet its business plan. That was one piece of evidence that we pled in support of the disclosure violation. It was not the entirety of the disclosure violation. The second disclosure violation that we pled, which was pled both as support for the first disclosure violation and also as a separate and independent disclosure violation, was the misclassification of Blockbuster's cash flows, which led to a restatement from $1.43 billion of operating cash flow in 2003 to $540 million or so of operating cash flow in 2003. The Court of Chancery dismissed that particular claim as not for lack of materiality, finding that it was not material as a matter of law. In holding that way, the court ruled that it was not something that we had shown would affect the deliberation of a reasonable shareholder. In our briefs in the Court of Chancery and in our brief to this court, we have shown that both the Securities and Exchange Commission and financial commentators, as well as accounting experts, disagree with the Court of Chancery's view that the difference between operational cash flow and cash flow from investment is not material, that those authorities demonstrate that distinction is very material to the investment community. The third disclosure violation that we alleged was a lack of disclosure regarding how the price that was offered in the exchange offer was calculated, the methodology and underlying analysis of the exchange offer price. There is, somewhat of a disagreement in the cases as to when underlying financial information and information about financial methodologies needs to be disclosed. In this circumstance, the court ruled that because there was no claim that the consideration was fair, and there was no claim that the consideration reflected the intrinsic value of the stock, that there was no need to disclose the underlying valuations. Our position, Your Honors, such as the Court of Chancery found in the Pure Resources case, is that when a board structures a transaction like this, there is an implicit representation that the price is fair. This is not a situation such as courts have ruled where courts have had to rule when a third party comes in and makes a proposal and the company simply takes no position on the third party's offer. This is a structure which was done at the direction and behest of the Viacom board of directors, the defendants in this case. Blockbuster was under their control. That's not a dispute. Viacom controlled the Blockbuster board of directors. That's not a matter that's been disputed. Sumner Redstone, the defendant, and other Viacom employees were members of the Blockbuster board. So this is a deal which Viacom decided to do, not Blockbuster. And it was presented to Viacom shareholders. In that circumstance, the Viacom defendants should be required to present all the facts which are material to the shareholders' decision as to whether to exchange their shares, which are within their possession. Lastly, and similarly to the last point, the composition of the special committee that considered the exchange offer on behalf of the Viacom Board of Directors, the identity of those members of the special committee was not disclosed in the prospectus. That is certainly something which is material and relevant to Viacom shareholders. It has long been the law that where members of a special committee suffer from disabling conflicts of interest, that those conflicts must be disclosed to shareholders. In this particular case, there is no way for any shareholder to have made an assessment as to whether at the time of the exchange offer any of the members of the special committee suffered from any conflict of interest, because there is no way of knowing whether or not the, who those members of the special committee were, because they chose not to disclose it.
Is it your position that any members of the special committee were conflicted?
We don't know who was on the special committee, but we know that many members of the Viacom Board of Directors have ties to Redstone. Others have ties to the financial advisor to the transaction, Bear Stearns. I believe it was Bear Stearns. I don't want to misspeak. And so it's our position that that's information that shareholders should have received in order to be able to make an adequate decision as to the adequacy of the price that was being offered in the exchange. The second issue, once you get beyond the issue as to whether or not we have sufficiently alleged disclosure violations, is whether or not we have adequately pled knowledge on the part of the director defendants of Viacom of those disclosure violations. The Loudoun case from this court and other cases from this court and the Court of Chancery make clear that in direct breach of fiduciary duty cases, unlike derivative breach of fiduciary duty cases, only general notice of the nature of the claim is required. Rule 9 states that knowledge must only be averred generally. Cases consistently hold that the only facts that must be pled are facts which support a reasonable inference of knowledge. The Court of Chancery below, I would suggest, applied a much stricter and stricter rule than that, and required much more in the way of pleading, and actually cited to the federal securities decision involving Blockbuster and the same Blockbuster transaction. And as this court knows, under federal securities law, plaintiffs must plead a strong inference of scienter, which goes even far beyond what is required under Rule 9, which, according to the rules of this court, Rule 9 does not even apply to the averment of knowledge. So applying federal securities law or federal securities decision as precedent for whether or not we have been able to plead knowledge is misplaced, considering the difference, the complete difference in the pleading standards, as well as for several other reasons regarding other differences between the types of the legal nature of the claims between breach of fiduciary duty and securities fraud.
With regard to your argument that there was an implicit representation that the price was fair, so the only way to make no representation is to affirmatively state that we make no representation that the price is fair.
I mean, I think they actually did say they make no representation that the price is fair. But were they structured the transaction, I believe that shareholders are entitled to assume that as fiduciaries, they're not structuring a transaction that they don't consider to be fair to their own shareholders. They're not entitled to act in a way that's not fair to their own shareholders. This isn't a case of a third party coming in and saying, this is the price that we want to offer you. If you don't like it, we're not willing to pay any more money, so we can't tell you that it's fair. We can't tell you that we've analyzed whether or not it's in your interest to take it. Take it or don't take it. That's when a third party comes in. When your own director defendants are acting and proposing an exchange offer to you, I think shareholders should have the right to assume that there is some representation being made to them that they considered the shareholders' interest, because they're only supposed to be acting in the shareholders' best interest when they make their decisions.
Can it be in the shareholders' interest just to be offered this opportunity, whether the price is fair or not, or whether there's been a careful analysis of the fairness of the price, that just, you know, this is a worthwhile price? prospect, and we're going to offer it to the stockholders. They can agree or disagree.
Well, if it's a worthwhile prospect, Your Honor, I think that that is exactly how shareholders would understand this. In real-world, practical terms, that's how shareholders would understand this. These directors have decided this is a worthwhile offer to make to us. They don't have any reason to believe that it's not fair to us. That's the way shareholders are really going to understand this. And if the directors have information about how this number was calculated, how they came up with this amount, then that information should be given to the shareholders so the shareholders can make an informed assessment. Beyond which, in this case, we have alleged that the directors had information that the company was not doing as well as was the public believed it to be doing. They had undisclosed information. So even putting aside the issue as to whether or not, if you make a representation, you need to disclose your analyses, in this particular circumstance, we have alleged facts sufficient, I believe, to demonstrate that the defendants had information that was not known to the public. And because they had information that was not known to the public about the financial condition of Blockbuster, they should have then gone further and disclosed all of that information, including their pricing methodology and financial analyses to the shareholders. Just as an example as the support for the fact that these directors did have knowledge, not only was there the document which we were told about, which is discussed in the court's opinion, the analysis of cash flows from the employee in the Treasury Department, but also this is a case where this transaction closed in early October of 2004. On October 27th, without anything having changed between October 4th and October 27th, on October 27th, this company started to reveal the problems that were hidden from the shareholders in early October when the transaction was closed. That's 3 weeks. Now, it's not 3 hours. I think something could have happened in that 3 weeks. There's nothing here that happened in those 3 weeks. The only thing that happened was the company began to reveal the problems which, according to the employees and the ex-employees that we interviewed, problems that they knew about prior to the exchange offer. In addition to the one witness who said that she prepared this one document about the cash flows, other witnesses from the Treasury Department, financial analysts testified that the treasurer, the CFO, and Mr. Antico, the CFO, I mean the CEO, all had received information from them and their colleagues regarding the problems with the company's business plan. That is very extensive information and widespread information within the company, considering the fact that Mr. Redstone, Mr. Dowman, and two other employees of Viacom were members of the Blockbuster Board of Directors, and considering the widespread, extensive nature of dissemination of this information at Blockbuster, under those circumstances, for pleading purposes, under Rule 8, it seems that would be more than a reasonable inference, certainly in comparison to many of the other cases that have found a reasonable inference to support a Rule 8 statement of knowledge. That would certainly seem to be more than sufficient to meet that standard. The defendants have an obligation, as the direct, especially the defendants, director defendants who were directors of Blockbuster as well, have an obligation to manage the affairs of the corporation. Under that circumstance, courts have found that when there is an extensive, widespread problem at a company, the defendants, at least for pleading purposes, in a direct case as opposed to a derivative case, can be inferred to have knowledge of that situation. In addition, the fact that the revenues were misclassified in the prospectus, the fact that the composition of the special committee was not disclosed, all of those things suggest that there was some effort in this circumstance to obfuscate and mislead shareholders, which of course is certainly circumstantial evidence of knowledge of a problem, which when looked at in combination with the other evidence that we have put forward would seem to support an inference of knowledge on the part of the defendants. The other point that I want to make, Your Honors, is that the Court of Chancery ruled that the entire fairness doctrine does not apply to this transaction, the review of this transaction. And one of the reasons, if not the primary reason, that the court ruled that way was the fact that Mr. Redstone did not participate in the exchange offer. And the fact that Mr. Redstone did not participate in the exchange offer is exactly the point of our claim. Mr. Redstone and the other director defendants acting at his behest of Viacom wanted to divest Viacom of its interest in Blockbuster because they knew that Blockbuster had severe operational problems, which are the severe operational problems which began to be revealed 3 weeks later after the transaction closed and which continued to be revealed over the course of the next year. They knew about those problems, and so he did not want to participate in the exchange offer. That's the whole point of our claim, is that this was an effort on the part, a wrongful effort on the part of the director defendants to divest themselves of their interest and Viacom's interest in Blockbuster. But they divested themselves by foisting it upon the Viacom shareholders, the Viacom minority shareholders. And that was improper, and it was done through misleading and incomplete disclosures. And the disclosures in and of themselves establish a claim for violation of breach of fiduciary duty. Separate and apart from that, we believe there is an entire fairness claim.
Thank you. Will you want to reserve the rest of your time?
Yes, please.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. As you know, this matter is parallels an action dismissed by a federal judge against Blockbuster and Viacom about a year ago, raising the exact same disclosure issues. And then Vice Chancellor Lamb dismissed it as against both Blockbuster and Viacom. The disclosure issues that they really raise were raised against Blockbuster, who's not before the court. They did not appeal the dismissal as against Blockbuster. And I am here representing Viacom, which was the controlling shareholder of the time of Blockbuster. As Your Honors know, what brings us here are two events, two transactions, neither one of which are in any way objectionable either then or now under any standard that we're of under Delaware law. First, Blockbuster issued a non-discriminatory pro rata dividend to all of their shareholders, including Viacom. The dividend, Viacom had control of Blockbuster. The dividend was done entirely pro rata. There were three independent Blockbuster directors who evaluated the propriety of the dividend. They've never challenged the independence or propriety of those three directors. They were advised by two financial advisors, by Lazard being the principal one. They were advised by Richard Layton. They determined that a pro rata dividend would be appropriate, and that Blockbuster, as part of the process, could easily afford the dividend. And they made the determination to announce a dividend, which, as I said, was announced purely pro rata. And under cases in this court, sketching back, as far as I know, to 1971, the Sinclair Oil case, there can't possibly be any structural or other issue involved with the declaration of a pro rata dividend, particularly when its declaration was done by a special committee.
We don't understand, or at least I don't understand, that the plaintiffs are attacking the dividend per se. Rather, their claim is that the dividend, however legal it may have been, stripped the asset, that is Blockbuster, of its ability to fulfill its business plan in the future. And having done that, the defendants then foisted that asset, which would not be able to perform, on the minority stockholders and didn't tell them that.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, and that's why the gist of this is disclosure, which I'll get to in a second. But the point is, The approval of the dividend and its impact on Blockbuster going forward was approved by Blockbuster by a special committee of the board. They challenged it below. It was dismissed. They haven't taken an appeal from that, from the declaration of the dividend or the propriety or the independence of the special committee that declared it. The second stage, then, is what
What are we to infer from that?
Well,
that is the complaint, nonetheless, alleges that the dividend stripped the asset, that is, deprived Blockbuster of its ability to fulfill any meaningful business plan.
I know, but, Your Honor, my point, let me turn to the disclosure then issue. It said, at the Blockbuster level, which declared the dividend, I said there was contemporaneous financial analysis disclosed to the shareholders with substantial cautionary warnings, as the federal judge found and Vice Chancellor Lamb both found, all of which were placed in the prospectus regarding the effect of the dividend on Blockbuster's future, its ability to fund its future business plan. It was all disclosed, and as I said, the underlying transaction was separately approved by Blockbuster, not Viacom. Then the second step of the analysis was Viacom effectuated a tax-free, voluntary, non-coercive exchange offer of its Blockbuster shares for Viacom shares. There was no recommendation made by Viacom in any way. It was said on the front page of the prospectus that there was no recommendation made. There was no suggestion of fairness. Every shareholder was told that they should make their own determination of the value of Blockbuster and of Blockbuster's future. And in this case in particular...
Well, it's argued that there's an implicit representation of fairness. Otherwise, why would it be offered?
Well, Your Honor, that can possibly, you know, there's plenty of law going back, you know, the Solomon versus Pathé case, the Frank case, which we cite in our brief, and indeed Justice Vice Chancellor Lamb, you know, in his opinion, cites on page 15 and 16 many cases in Delaware law that say that a self-tender that's non-coercive and does not contain a recommendation or a suggestion of fairness, that is not a fairness situation. If rather every self-tender by a company is always something a company does on behalf of its shareholders in theory, but the court draws a line between self-tenders that are self-tenders that are coercive in some way and those that are not. And there was nothing coercive about this. And what the Vice Chancellor found was that there was nothing coercive about this in any way, and then he turned to the disclosure issues. The issues, therefore, became issues of disclosure.
So if there's no representation as to fairness, it's let the buyer beware.
If there's no recommendation or no suggestion of fairness, then it's not an entire fairness situation. And what flows from that, for example, that they have to disclose the valuation methodologies that went into this, which they did, by the way. They said, we chose a premium for the exchange offer, which we think will make the exchange offer succeed. That's what they disclosed was the basis of the premium. But that's as far as they have to go. And under many cases, again, the Solomon versus Pathé case or the Frank case, we think there's just no issue that a non-coercive exchange offer without any recommendation of any type, as long as the disclosures are fair, that and there's legions of law in this court, and that's what Vice Chancellor Lamb cited in page 15 and 16 of his decision, that there's no colorable basis for a claim of fairness as long as the disclosures were fair. And I'd like to turn to the disclosures, which is what you raised, Mr. Justice. Let me address the two principal pieces of disclosure that were suggested to the court, recognizing we're talking about Viacom here, not Blockbuster. Because if you look at the allegations in the complaint, except for paragraph 68, there is no allegation in the complaint in any way that anyone at the Viacom level knew about these historical operational issues that were months old that they raised in the course of their complaint. They allege different figures at the Blockbuster level that were told, for example, they allege that there were operational questions regarding Blockbuster. There is no allegation with respect to Viacom in any way, shape, or form. And Justice Lamb probed them on this. And he said to them, what is the basis for paragraph 68? The only allegation they make about Viacom's knowledge in paragraph 68, they said Sumner Redstone knew about operational problems and particularly a seven-month-old report that was prepared by an assistant treasurer in the an employee of the Treasury Department 7 months earlier, which the treasurer himself rejected. And Vice Chancellor Lamb said, why in the world would directors of a company, of a different company that happened to be controlling shareholders, why would they possibly know about this minor document? And he asked them for what's the basis for their claim that Sumner Redstone knew. And if you turn, Your Honors, to because he wanted to determine whether there's any reasonable basis to believe that information would have been available to them. And what you find if you turn to the oral argument, and this person will read some detail,
you turn to the oral argument, as the Chancellor found, all they said on page 1895 of the record in the course of their argument is, Redstone must have known. We have no factual basis for you to say he did, but he must have known because the actual CEO of Blockbuster must have known, and he would have told Redstone about these problems, and that Redstone therefore would have told the other Viacom directors about these problems. And this was characterized by Vice Chancellor Lamb as a daisy chain of surmise and illogic, because this document that they relied on to show infirmity at the Blockbuster level was a document that was 7 months old, a document which they ended up admitting in court, saying to the court they had read and that it was so important that everyone at Viacom would have known about it. They then retracted that omission. They offered to deliver the document to Vice Chancellor Lamb and then never did so. Now they tell us in their brief that they never heard of this document, haven't seen this document, that they represented to the court they would deliver. And the document was 7 months old at the time. There were two contemporaneous valuations that were included in the prospectus. And in the Frank case of this court, a Merrill Lynch valuation that was only a month old was considered too stale. This was 7 months old. It was done by a junior treasurer in the Treasury Department. They plead it was rejected by the treasurer itself. They never pled it got to Viacom in any way, shape, or form. And that was the basis of their disclosure claim about the operational problems at Blockbuster.
Wasn't there an allegation along the lines of these operational problems were well known at Blockbuster and were the subject of a lot of discussion?
In fact, Your Honor, if you look, for example, at the amended complaint, if you look in paragraphs
61, 62, 63, they talk about how the document was distributed to middle-level executives at Blockbuster, which one might expect a document like that to be distributed to. There's no allegation by anyone that the document was ever distributed to anyone at the Viacom level. And what Justice Lamb said is, there is no logical reason to think that a seven-month-old document embedded in the Treasury Department, which the Treasurer himself rejected, they so pled, he concluded there's no reason to believe that that document ever found its way to the directors or was reasonably available to them. And without pleading that they had knowledge of it, or without pleading that it was reasonably available to them, there can't possibly be a disclosure obligation on the part of directors to disclose an operational document that they had no knowledge about.
Well, is it the document or is it the underlying alleged facts as to Blockbuster's precarious financial situation that the disclosure allegation goes to?
Well, right. They say now, well, we're not really relying so much on the document, which was what the whole case below was about. But we're saying more generally Viacom people knew. But there is no such pleading. The only pleading of knowledge you're going to find with respect to Viacom, because remember, the evaluation of the dividend was being done at the Blockbuster level
with independent financial advisors. The only allegation you're going to find in the complaint about Viacom's knowledge is paragraph 68. And there you're going to find this. They said Redstone knew about these things. They don't say how or why he would have known about them. And as I said, when Justice Lamb, when Vice Chancellor Lamb pressed them, how did you know, why would Redstone have known about these things? They said he must have known. They have no basis whatsoever to support that allegation, which is one reason why the Vice Chancellor rejected it. And you'll find that if you look at the transcript at page 1895, appendix 1895, you'll find a colloquy with the Vice Chancellor and the plaintiff's lawyers as to what's the possible basis for the knowledge as to Redstone. With respect to the other Viacom directors, they don't even claim they knew. They said they knew or they should have known about these operational difficulties, but they allege absolutely no basis for a finding of knowledge, and that's what, for a conclusion of a factual recital of knowledge, and that's what the Vice Chancellor found after probing them as to the basis for their belief that this information would have found its way to the Viacom board.
Well, with respect to this issue about knowledge and the report that somebody they spoke to had seen or written or whatever, the trial court seemed particularly perturbed about that whole issue as to, you know, where is the report? You said you'd give us the report. You never did. That tends to prove that what you were representing to the court was wrong or was without basis. And from my understanding of the way a motion to dismiss works, you don't make evaluations about underlying levels of proof. You look to see whether the allegations state a claim if they were true. And then you get discovery and you find out whether Mr. Redstone did or didn't know anything about this and whether everybody was talking about this assistant treasurer's report or whether maybe they weren't all talking about it, whether it was rejected or not rejected and why it was rejected and so on. My concern is that perhaps the trial court was moving ahead of itself on the supposition that after discovery there wouldn't be anything to support this and therefore the claim wouldn't survive, so I'm going to throw it out now.
Well, I don't think that's quite accurate. I think what he asked was, did they plead with any basis that they knew, or alternatively, did they plead that it was reasonably available so they would have known? And that, I think, is the standard. See, in the reply brief, you'll see they've shifted. They now say all we have to show is the document was out there somewhere and they had access to it. But what he asked, what the Vice Chancellor Lamb asked, and I think was the right thing to ask, because the standard is, did they know, or if they didn't know, was it reasonably available to them? They should have known. And what he concluded was, as they described the document, it was, again, a document that was 7 months old at the time of the transaction, embedded in the treasury function of the company, rejected by the treasurer. He said, why would the board of directors ever know about that? And he pressed them, why was it reasonably available to the board? And that's when they made the concession, well, Redstone must have known. And there's nothing more than that to this claim of knowledge with respect to these underlying problems at Blockbuster, which I remind you really didn't materialize till months and months and even years later, which is why they filed this lawsuit 2 years later. They didn't file the lawsuit at the time of the transaction. They filed the lawsuit 2 years later after the federal judge had already concluded that there was no basis for a disclosure claim. Let me raise the question, if I can, about the cash flow issue, which was totally misconstrued by them. And the cash flow issue is simply this. In the case of Viacom, in the case of Blockbuster, 18 months after the transaction, and again, no reason whatsoever to believe that Viacom's directors would know that 18 months later, Blockbuster was going to have to reclassify some of its financial statements. But what happened 18 months later is that Blockbuster, after consulting with the SEC, basically transferred their tapes and CDs that they sell, The SEC said these should be classified as a, rather not as a non-current asset, but as a current asset. That had the effect of transferring non-current capitalized expense into current operational expense, which resulted in cash flow from operations being down, but cash flow from investments being exactly up dollar for dollar. So when the justice, when Vice Chancellor pressed them to say, this is just geography, it changed nothing. It had zero impact on revenue. It had zero impact on income. It had zero impact on free cash flow. It had zero impact on available cash. It had zero impact on Blockbuster's covenants. And it had zero impact on its stock price when the restatement was made 18 months later. So what the Vice Chancellor quite appropriately said is, this was purely a classification issue. It is not like the Wall Street Journal article they quote, which says that investment cash flow can be different from current cash flow. At times it is. If you have trading income, for example, cash flow from trading, that could be a one-time event, what the Wall Street Journal refers to as a sideline event. But that's not what this is. This reclassification 18 months later went to the core business of Blockbuster. How do you treat the tapes and CDs that they sell? They classified it one way previously. The SEC said you probably ought to classify it a different way, which they did. It had zero impact on cash or the availability of dollar bills for them to fund their business plan. And most importantly, there was never any basis of any kind to suggest that anyone at Viacom could have known 18 months before that 18 months later, Blockbuster was going to make an accounting readjustment that basically moved, changed the buckets of its cash flow from operating into investment cash flow. Your Honors, the transaction was structured very, very straightforwardly. There were 15 pages of disclosures of copious warnings about the future of Blockbuster. Everyone understood that its future was dependent on coming up with a rational business model in the internet age. 15 pages of copious disclosures. There was no disclosure violation here. There was no recommendation. There was no suggestion of fairness. And a premium was offered, which was paid. It
Thank
was
you.
Years Your later before up. This materialized. Thank you.
Your Honors, I believe that we quote a case in our brief under the federal securities law, which talks about risk factors, which I think aptly sums up the situation in this case. If you yell to someone that they're approaching a ditch in the road, that they might be coming upon a ditch in the road, and you know that they're about to come upon the Grand Canyon, that's not adequate disclosure of risk factors. If you have knowledge of a problem, and you have knowledge that a problem has occurred, and you have knowledge that the problem is a certainty, then telling somebody that there might be a problem in the future is not adequate and truthful disclosure, particularly when you are a fiduciary asking the people whose interest you serve to take action. Your Honor, the reason why self-tenders are different, the typical self-tender is different from this situation, is that, for one reason, this situation involved Blockbuster stock. In the Frank case, which is actually, I believe, the only self-tender that was cited by the Court of Chancery. The other cases, I believe, are tenders by third parties, not by the corporations themselves. In the Frank case was a self-tender by a corporation, but it was a self-tender where the corporation was paying cash for its stock. So the stock was trading at a particular price. The company came along and said, we're going to pay you in excess above that price. Whether that case was rightly or wrongly decided, it was a Court of Chancery case, this situation is different because the payment was made in Blockbuster stock. And because it was made in Blockbuster stock and it was not made in cash, shareholders of Viacom have a right to believe that the Viacom director defendants do not have any information regarding the value of that Blockbuster stock that's not being provided to them. That certainly seems to be reasonable and consistent with the opinions of this court on what kind of information needs to be disclosed to shareholders.
So the rule that you would have us write is whenever it's a transaction not involving cash, all of these details must be disclosed in every instance. Otherwise, there's an implicit representation that it's fair.
Sufficient details must be disclosed. Yes, sufficient. Not all information, but sufficient information within the knowledge of, within the possession of the fiduciary should be disclosed to those from whom the fiduciaries are seeking action. And also in this circumstance, we allege that they had additional information.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement and have a brief recess.